Questioning Paul, Chapter 5, Part 4.
Adding fuel to the fire, as we shall soon witness in Ephesus, in Acts 19, Paul admits to setting boundaries for Yahusha's disciples, notably Shimon and Yahochanan, and even Cephas's comments regarding Paul's epistles were used in a way the rock never intended, rather than being seen correctly as a warning to God's sheep, telling them to be on their guard lest Paul's epistles confuse them and lead them to their own demise. Christendom twisted what Peter wrote to infer that Paul's letters were scripture. The disciple had been taken to a place he did not intend to go. Beyond the fact that these words came from the mouth of God, beyond the fact that this was his last prophecy prior to returning to heaven, Yahusha is translated using Zimeno, a word which affirms that this was a prophetic prediction, one which was designed to clearly communicate a future event, making it known to us. As such, only a fool would ignore its implications, one focused upon the most deadly plague ever foisted upon humankind. And in this light, there is only one possible perpetrator, the man who did this very thing. We have already examined Banados, associating it with the Hebrew Deborah, so we recognize that the revelation Yahusha wanted to make perfectly clear was the demise of billions of diseased souls, all separated from their shepherd, from life, nourishment, protection, and guidance, as a result of the words one man would write while doxasitun, attributing his opinions to God, and that, more than anything else, was the problem. Had Shaul not claimed that his message was inspired, he would have been summarily rejected for being insane, for being arrogant, presumptuous, and delusional. But Paul provided a new, entirely different way to view God, one that made salvation as simple as believing. There was nothing to know, nothing to do, and the saved were at liberty to sin. All that was required was to believe Paul while ignoring God, his prophets, and his disciples. As a compound of A, signifying unity and being part of, and Kaleuthos, the way, Yahusha used Ekalautheo to tell Shimon to follow the way, the narrow path to God continually described by Yahusha as being accurately and completely delineated within the Torah. This is especially relevant when considered adjacent to Habakkuk 2 verse 5.
Moreover, because the intoxicating wine and inebriating spirit of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal who tries to influence and control others without justification through trickery and deceit, is a high-minded moral failure, an arrogant and meritless man of presumption, so he will not rest, find peace, nor live. Whoever is open to the broad path, the duplicitous and improper way associated with Shaul, he and his soul are like the plague of death. And so those who are brought together by him, receiving him, those who associate with and join him, those who are removed and withdrawn from the company of God, assembling with him, will not be satisfied. All of the Gentiles will gather together unto him, all of the people from different races and places.
Written as a kaloe, it was rendered in the present active imperative tense. The use of the present active tense indicates that he wanted the man he had trained to follow the way right now, at this very instant, and never stop. The imperative mood was deployed to express that this instruction was subject to the exercise of free will, and yet it was expressing an earnest desire. This was supportive advice upon which a choice should be made, and thus in full recognition that Shimon's volition was in play. Yahusha wanted the rock to follow his way to the Father, not Paul's way of faith, which was different, by his own admission, and led in the opposite direction. Should you want additional proof that it was appropriate to refer to Shaul as a wolf in sheep's clothing, let's turn our attention to Bereshith/Genesis 49 verse 27. There, Yahweh spoke about Shaul, the man who has become the most infamous member of Benjamin's tribe. But first, let's affirm that Paul was from the tribe of Benjamin. The wolf in sheep's clothing wrote, notably and admittedly communicating his own personal mantra, wrote, plus al I say, therefore, not pushed away, rejected, or repudiated the God the people of him not may it be. And yet indeed, I, myself, am an Israelite, from the seed of Abram, the tribe of Benjamin. Romans 11 verse 1. While the connection to Benjamin was all we were looking for, I'd be remiss if I didn't correct Paul's erroneous statements. God temporarily rejected Israel and Hosea, divorcing them for infidelity because they, like Paul, embraced the religions of the Gentiles. And he has repudiated their political and religious leaders countless times for their false teachings. So while Israel and Yahudim will be reconciled with Yahweh on the day of reconciliations in 2033, Paul's "not may it be" is in direct conflict with God's testimony. Further, Israel and Yahudim were supposed to be a people set apart unto Yahweh, making them the antithesis of Laos, common. However, since Shaul has shown his utter disregard for Abraham, consistently referring to him by his pre-covenant name, Abram, and will profess in his letter to the Galatians that the covenant he formed with Yahweh enslaved and thus had to be replaced, it's Shaul who has rejected Israel. He also repudiated Moses and the Torah, Daud and his songs he wrote to the Torah, and all of the Hebrew prophets, including the most Hebrew of prophets, Yahusha, even pushing his disciples, all of whom were Israelites, away. Since we know that Paul has a propensity to twist God's word, it is incumbent upon us to determine why. And in this case, the reason is obvious. Paul's theory is that since God has not rejected all of his people, at least according to Paul, it serves to reason that he has not repudiated me, for indeed I, myself, am an Israelite. Simply stated, Paul was bad to the bone. Also, there was a twinge of Shaul's messianic complex being revealed here because Paul said that he is from the seed, singular, of Abram, a distinction that would otherwise be redundant to being an Israelite. The notion that there was only one seed of Abram will be twisted in the third and fourth chapters of Galatians to jump from Abraham to Yahusha, bypassing the Torah. But now according to Shaul, he, himself, is that seed. Before we consider Yahweh's prediction regarding Shaul, the Benjamite, remember that in the Chabaqwq/Habakkuk prophecy which calls Shaul out by name, we find a reference to a later time.
So therefore the expectation and subsequent realization of this revelation from God is for the appointed meeting time. It provides a witness to and speaks in the end. Whatever extended period of time is required for this question to be resolved, this shall not be proven false. Expect him in this regard, because indeed he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. Habakkuk 2 verse 3.
With this in mind, the preamble to Yahweh's next indictment is found in Genesis 49 verse 1, where we read,
"And Jacob called his sons and said, Gather together so that I may declare to you what is to befall you in the last days."
Then, speaking of this Benjamite, and his animosity toward the Messiah, who was presented coming from Yahudah in verses 8 to 12, the Torah reveals that at the time of the Messiah,
Benjamin is a wolf viciously tearing apart, continually mangling and actually killing in the morning, consistently devouring his prey, and in the evening he divides and destroys that which has been spoiled. Genesis 49 verse 27.
The horrible crime perpetrated by this wolf from the tribe of Benjamin would occur during the very period of time Yahusha predicted. In the 10th verse of this same discussion, we were told,
"And the tribe and scepter shall not depart from Yahweh, or the staff of the leader with the authority to inscribe instructions for understanding his footsteps, until indeed the arrival of Shiloh."
At the close of the fourth millennia, every tribe except Yahudah and Benjamin were lost and thus unknown, this being the legacy of the Assyrian conquest of the northern kingdom 600 years earlier. And immediately after Shaul penned his last letter, it became impossible for either of the two remaining tribes to demonstrate affiliation because Rome razed the temple where all of their genealogical records were stored. As such, the time marked from the arrival of Shiloh to the destruction of temple is so constrained, there really is no other viable candidate for this dire prophecy other than Shaul. Hebrew lexicons affirm that Benyamin is a compound of Ben, meaning son, and Yamin, conveying either right hand, or south. As such, we might see this connotation reflected in Shaul's attempt to take the upper hand and position himself as God's right-hand man, thereby replacing Yahusha and his disciples. Or perhaps, this could be a reference to Paul leading his flock Christians south, and therefore back into the wilderness. Also interesting, Shaul has already spoken of the right hand being offered to him. And it has become obvious that Shaul, a man whose name is indistinguishable from Sheol, served at Satan's right hand. Perhaps also we should look at Yam in the name's root. Yam is the Hebrew word for sea, and it is symbolic of Gawan, distinct from Yahudim who are associated with the Eretz, land. It is hard to miss Paul's repetitive and braggadocious claim of dominion over Gentiles. As we examine Yahweh's Torah prediction, we find that the roof, plucking the life out of his victims, is an accurate prophetic portrayal of what Shaul would do to Christians, in addition to being a rather precise match for Thanatos in Yahusha's statement to Shimon. Written in the Kal imperfect, as was Akel, consistently devouring, Teruf, viciously killing, reveals that the wolf actually tore them apart, continually mangling what God had promised, consistently ripping the life out of the Torah, which ultimately led to the ongoing and unfolding death of countless Christian souls. Shaul continually devoured the truth, leaving nothing but a rotting and neglected carcass in his wake. Shaul was indeed cunning as Ahab, wolf. He was a predator, masquerading as the shepherd's right hand, while dressed as one of his sheep, all to pluck souls away from the flock. Bakr, in the morning, meaning the first part of the day, provides is also insightful. To begin, Paul was the first to mangle Yahusha's message. As Thomas Jefferson wrote, Paul was the great Corypheus, voice and leader of the chorus, and the first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus. From Jefferson's letter to W. Short, published in The Great Thoughts by George Sedes, Ballantine Books, 1985, page 208, second, Paul's treachery occurred at the very onset of the fifth day of human history, at least as measured from the fall of Adam. So this timing is indicative of his arrival. According to the Genesis account and history, this is the time of confusion when new religions would and now have ravaged the world. Third, the morning reference adroitly connects Yahusha's breakfast conversation, in which the prophecy warning about Paul's predatory practices was revealed. It makes an otherwise extraneous comment relevant. And fourth, Shaul began his career murdering those who came to know and trust Yahusha. Acts 7 verse 58, 8 verses 1 to 3, and 9 verse 1, and then in Galatians 2 verse 9, he claims Gentiles as his exclusive territory, thereby marking his prey. His constant wrangling for money, or plunder, would then dominate his later writings, and thus represent the evening of his career, all in keeping with the prophecy. Akel, rendered devouring, and meaning to eat and feed upon, in addition to consume, ruin, and destroy something valuable, is an even more exacting fit for Yahusha's prediction. It was in the act of feeding God's sheep that Paul viciously savaged and devoured Peter. Likewise, Yahweh is not speaking of wolves and their prey, in a literal sense, but instead of predators, and their victims, which would be his sheep. In other words, the wolf and sheep references adroitly connect these two predictions. Arab, translated evening, is indistinguishable in the Hebrew text from Arab, which means desolate and lifeless, in addition to making a pledge which exchanges one thing for another. Paul's promise was that belief in his gospel of grace replaced trusting the Torah. And lest we forget, Shaul's credibility was derived from his encounter on the road to Damascus and his subsequent imagined journey to Arabia. Halak doesn't just mean divides and destroys. It also speaks of someone who is a smooth talker and a slick operator, as well as of the slippery slope they led their victims down to their ruin. Halak is flattery, words that reflect a legitimate praise, and it describes the use of seductive words which are deployed to persuade people in a suggestive manner. Paul was the poster child for Halak. Additionally, Halak is a smooth stone used as an impromptu religious altar, and as a stand-in for an imaginary god. Grace, Grasha, and Therese fit this bogus bill. And that leaves us with Shalal, the spoils, the victims and their possessions. At the end of the day, under the cover of darkness, Paul's legacy, the Christian Church, divvies up what they have been able to confiscate from the lives of those they have destroyed. So it is hard to miss the connections between Paul and Benjamin, and between Yahusha's predictive description and Yahusha's prophetic warning. Benjamin was not only the last name on Yahusha's list, and the last prophecy in Bereshit/Genesis, the prophetic reference to Shaul was the last prediction Yahusha would make before he returned to heaven. Once again, there is but one man in all of human history who fits Yahusha's and Yahusha's prophecies: Shaul. Before we move on, it should also be noted that Yahusha provided other Benjamites a better option.
Concerning Benjamin, he said, "The beloved of Yahusha choose to consistently and genuinely live by approaching with absolute confidence through complete trust upon His, the Almighty's, protective covering over and around him each and every day, and by understanding his supportive garment and his outstretched arm he lives." Deuteronomy 33 verse 12.
Absolute confidence is the antithesis of faith, putting Yahusha's declaration in irreconcilable opposition to the fulcrum of Pauline doctrine, of salvation through faith. Diligent and disciplined observation of the prevailing evidence followed by careful and discerning consideration leads to knowing and understanding, which in turn facilitate trust, and thus complete confidence. And remember, Yahusha is the outstretched arm and hand of Yahusha. Yahusha's prophetic warning to Shimon was the last he would make before returning home, but some 39 years later, Yahusha warned Yahalchanan about the same wannabe apostle, and those who had now leagued with him. He said to his beloved disciple,
"To the messenger of those called out in Ephesus write."
This was one place where Yahalchanan's and Shaul's footsteps and writings crossed paths. Therefore, the Messiah revealed the following regarding those Yahalchanan had shepherded and the wolf and his self-proclaimed apostles had tried to snatch away.
"I am aware of and recognize your works and undertakings, the difficult and exhausting encounters, and your unswerving and enduring perseverance, and that you cannot possibly accept, tolerate, support, nor endure that which is incorrect, immoral, injurious, pernicious, destructive, or baneful. And you have observed, examined, and objectively tested those who claim and maintain of themselves that they are apostles but are not, and you have found them false, deceitful, and deliberate liars." Revelation 2 verse 2.
It is especially relevant to this statement that Ephesus was the only city listed among the seven described in Yahusha's Revelation letters where Paul and his pals were known to have preached. And it is the only one with a warning against false apostles. Surely this is not a coincidence. While Revelation is a prophetic book, Yahusha's commendation was written in the present and past tense. And that is significant because Yahalchanan scribed Revelation in 69 CE, 7 years after Shaul wrote his letter to the Ephesians, and 2 years after the self-proclaimed apostle's death. So considering the fact that Paul and his traveling companions were the only men who claimed to be apostles in Ephesus during this short span of time, Yahusha was calling Shaul inerrant, demonic, deceitful, charlatan. We are without excuse. Christians cannot claim that they were not warned about this horrible man. Even Yahusha's parting comments parallel things we have read pertaining to the distinction between Yahusha's way and Paul's way.
"And you have loyal steadfastness and enduring consistency and have endured through my name. You have worked hard and have not grown tired." Revelation 2 verse 3.
Since I've made the claim that Paul and comrades preached in Ephesus, that they presented a contrarian view to that of Yahusha's disciples, notably, Yahalchanan, and thus singled themselves out as being the deceitful liars who were falsely claiming to be apostles, let's consider the evidence. I'll be providing this testimony largely based upon the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament, 27th edition with MCREYNOLDS English Interliter to be as accurate and fair as possible. This is Paul's personal testimony as recorded by Luke, and so as we have come to expect, much of what he said is difficult to comprehend.
But it became in the Apollos to be in Corinth, Paulos, having gone through the uppermost parts, came down to Ephesus so as to find some disciples, 19 verse 1, but he said against and regarding them, if conditionally, Spirit Holy you received having trusted the ones but to him but not if Spirit Holy there is we heard. He said, but into what then were you imst? And they said, into Yahawchanan's immersion. 19 verses 2-3, but Paul said, Yahawchanan imst immersion of change mind to the people, saying to the coming after him that they might believe this is in the Ists. So having heard, they were imst into the name of the Lord Iesu, 19 verses 4-5, and having set on them the hands of Paul, it came, the Spirit of the Holy on them. They were speaking but in tongues and were uttering prophecy, were but the all manners 12, Acts 19 verse 1-7.
While it is impossible based upon the quality of this testimony to know for certain what actually happened, I suspect that based upon information Paul received from Apollos in Corinth, Shaul felt threatened. He recognized that his message was vastly different than Yahusha's disciples, and he was convinced that one or more of them was treading upon his claim to have exclusive dominion over every race and nation. So he headed south, arriving in Ephesus to find the disciples responsible for the encroachment and then to re-establish himself as the exclusive source of salvation for Greeks and Romans. When he arrived, rather than meeting with Shimon or Yahalchanan, Shaul sought to undermine them, suggesting that the spirit they received as a result of responding to Yahalchanan was not the right spirit. This is why Paul used prose to say that his contrarian message was regarding and against the disciples, not to them. But then this dialogue gets a bit murky because Paul's next sentence has two hypothetical conditions, three buts, and a negation. And yet as we continue to read, some things become abundantly clear. When Paul learned that these people had been immersed in Yahalchanan's message, Paul immediately claimed that Yahalchanan had changed it, altering their thinking. He then questioned the nature of the spirit they had received. He told them that they should instead believe that his Lord Isu had sent him. So after listening to Paul's contrarian view, a dozen Ephesians were rebaptized by Paul, with Paul laying his hands on them in the name of his Lord. This then imbued these men with an entirely different spirit, one which caused them to blather on in tongues, believing that they were inspired prophets. But whatever they were saying, they were now Shaul's 12 disciples, just as Yahusha had chosen 12. These things known, Yahusha never once immersed or baptized anyone, so there is no need for it and no established way to do it. Therefore, it is as absurd to say that Yahalchanan's technique was wrong and Shaul's was right, as it is to baptize anyone in the name of the Lord Isu. Further, baptism is not the means Yahweh or Yahusha designated to receive the set-apart spirit. There is no mention of it anywhere in the Torah. And adding insult to injury, when the spirit came upon those who were set apart in Ura which hold on 7 status, they were empowered to speak the languages of the nations surrounding Israel. They were not baptized, there was no laying on of hands, they knew nothing of Shaul, they did not speak in tongues, and they did not prophesize. That was bad, but it gets worse. Paul was just warming up.
But having gone into the synagogue he was preaching fearlessly for 3 months, disputing and persuading about the kingdom of the God. Acts 19 verse 8.
Here, preaching fearlessly, was from parhesiazomai, which means that he was using the freedom to speak in a daring manner. It is a compound of pa, which means individually, and rio, meaning to pour forth. So let there be no mistake. This was Shaul's message and his alone. Even more insightful, disputing, was from dialegomai, which means to argue against someone using different thinking. It is to contend with and convince though discourse. Moving on to pto, Rather than being translated persuading, it could have been rendered seducing. It also means to win the favor of others by misleading and coaxing them, even to conciliate and strive to please. Also, take notice of the order of the verbs. The message and spirit of Yahalchenin had to be dialogomai, disputed, even argued against by presenting a different message, prior to Popto, persuading others to obey him, winning them over and seducing them to become his followers. Popto speaks of tranquilizing those who listen, inducing them through words to believe, persuading them to favor one individual over another and to join with them. So it is hard to miss the fact that Paul is confessing to the crime Yahalsha, addressed in his letter to Ephesus through Yahalchenin. I have always held hypocrites in low esteem. Shaul was a textbook case. He erroneously presented his gospel of grace as the alternative to obeying God's Torah, which he presents as an onerous set of laws. And while there is no Hebrew word for obey, and while Torah does not mean law, Shaul routinely lashed out at people for not obeying him. Continuing to rely on the Nestle Allen's MCREYNOLDS English interlinear to recount Paul's testimony, while augmenting and clarifying it using the most highly esteemed lexicons, we find:
But as some were being stubborn and they were disobedient, speaking abusively of and maligning the way before the crowd, having revolted against, forsaken, alienated, and separated from them, he appointed and marked off boundaries, separating the disciples through daily disputes in the lecture hall of Tyrannus, 19 verse 9, and this took place for 2 years so that everyone residing the Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Judeans and Greeks, Acts 19 verse 9 to 10.
Since Paul was speaking, setting aside the hyperbole, the last statement was true, at least for those who know that the Lord is Satan. Yahalsha, explanation, stating that there were some in Ephesus who did not believe Paul, has been resoundingly borne out in his own words. And while Yahalsha praised the Ephesians for rejecting the liar in his lies, Shaul saw them differently. The very people Yahalsha commended, Shaul condemned, calling them sklernomai, stubborn, hard-headed, and obstinate, even offensive and intolerable, refusing to listen. Based upon skleros, Paul viewed those he could not beguile as hard, harsh, and rough men who were stern, intolerant, offensive, and violent. That's almost funny considering the source. Shaul went on to say that his rivals were apatheo, which means that he saw the disciples as being insubordinate, because they disobeyed him and rejected his faith. If that doesn't take your breath away, considering whom he was rebelling against, I'd check your pulse. The most egotistical and presumptuous man to perhaps ever live called the disciples Yahalsha, had chosen and taught apatheo, disobedient, and that was because they apatheo, refused to believe him when his message differed from the one God had conveyed in word and deed. So Paul was laying down the law, his law, to which everyone had to obey or suffer the consequences. There was indeed a new Lord in town. The next verb in Paul's intolerant diatribe was translated speaking abusively of and maligning. It is from kakalageo, which is to curse and revile, denouncing through evil and insulting speech. The verb is a compound of kakos, which describes that which is of a bad nature, and is an inappropriate mode of thinking, feeling, or acting which is troublesome, pernicious, baneful, and wicked, and logos, the spoken word. Paul, like all insecure people, was ever ready to curse his perceived opponents, but would not tolerate reciprocation. Yahalsha and his disciples are often translated using histeri to convey that God stood up for us so that we could stand with him, but Paul's twist on this is markedly different. Aphistomai, rendered having revolted against, forsaken, alienated, and separated from them, is colored by apo, which speaks of separation, even of abandonment. It tells us that Paul caused a rebellion, and then avoided association, forsaking and abandoning, misleading and withdrawing from, the disciples. It was and continues to be, Paul against everyone, from Yahweh and Yahalsha, to Abraham, Moses, and the disciples. aphorize, translated he appointed and marked off boundaries, separating the disciples, means that sure will be exactly what Yahusha warned Shimon and Yahochanan would occur. Paul set aside and excluded them in an attempt to get rid of the disciples, severing the relationship while excommunicating them in an attempt to drive them out of Asia. By selecting this word, Paul was admitting to excluding the disciples because he claimed that they were disreputable. Aphorize is also from apo, to separate, but then horizo to define, setting boundaries and limits, determining and appointing territory. Aphorizo's primary connotation is therefore to determine, to define, and to mark off boundaries for those who are disreputable, specifically to separate them by establishing limits which they may not transgress, excluding them. And since the objects of such constraints were Yahusha's disciples, Paul was confessing to the very crime Yahusha warned Shimon and Yahochanan about. Contentious to the bitter end, Paul once again bragged of dialegomai, arguing against and disputing the disciples because their thinking was markedly different. But this time Paul was not to be found in the synagogue, in the place where those seeking to learn about Yahweh considered his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He turned to the Tyrannos school. Tyrannos is based upon kurios, denoting the Lord as a tyrant. So this time there should be no mistaking that Paul's Lord was a tyrant and despot seeking supremacy. And Paul was lecturing on his behalf. It is a fact little known, but if Paul's preaching is reflected in his letters, he never accurately conveyed anything Yahusha said. In just one of his 13 letters he made a brief passing attempt, citing a few words Yahusha spoke about Passover, albeit completely out of context, and even then he misquoted him, so rest assured, when Shaul claims that everyone in Asia heard him preach the word of the Lord, it was preaching Satan's mantra. Yahweh consistently refers to the adversary as Baal, Lord, because Satan, like Shaul, craves supremacy, mastery, control, obedience, subordination, and ownership. Paul's predilection for these very same things is revealing. Yahweh and Yahusha routinely tell us that dunamis, ability, inherent power, miracles, signs, and wonders, typify false prophets. But since Christians don't listen to either, they typically associate such things with God. And yet here, Paul is saying that God had nothing to do with them. His supernatural power and his extraordinary mastery and skill were the work of his hands, conceived, fashioned, and brought forth without God's assistance.
Miraculous and supernatural power and not having obtained in association with the God word performed through the hands of Paul. Acts 19 verse 11.
I realize that this sounds too incriminating to be true, not unlike Paul admitting to being both insane and demon-possessed. So I encourage skeptics to verify the meaning of T, likewise in corresponding to as the marker of a relationship, to, serving as a negation and denial, tas, the definite article in the accusative, denoting a direct object, and especially tijikano, sometimes transliterated tachchano, for yourself. Tijikano, which as I have noted, was negated in this statement by you, not in any way, and precedes tasphios, of God, speaks of having disclaimed an experience with God, having disavowed happening upon or meeting with God, and of not having a relationship with God, and while that's indicting, using its secondary connotation we find Paul admitting to not hitting the mark regarding extraordinary and unexpected performances which require uncommon skill. Therefore, it appears that the very attitude which got Satan expelled from heaven is now afflicting Paul.
Also to that on the being weak to be carried away from the skin of him handkerchiefs or aprons and to be settled from them the illnesses the and annoying spirits to depart out. Acts 19 verse 12.
End of part 4.